Calling the meeting of the Finance Administration and Oversight Committee to order. First item on the agenda is approval, first item on the agenda is approval of the agenda. Are there any additions, changes, modifications to the agenda? If not, without objection, the agenda is approved. Second item is approval of the minutes. Minutes of March 5th are very, very simple. Are there any changes to those minutes? If not, without objection, those minutes are approved. I would note that for the minutes for March 12th, you have a blue sheet that has changed. You may want to take a quick look at that. It's different from what was mailed out. The changes are fairly minor. But it changes the word subsidy to the word service and reduces the subsidy. If there are no additional comments on the minutes of March 12th, they are, without objection, they are adopted as modified. Minutes of March 26th, these are rather substantially modified. Look at the blue sheet in your book again. It's on the back of the same page. This was modified to try to more faithfully reflect the rather complex series of transactions that we did on March 26th, where we approved two different resolutions that went to the board. The only change I would make to these, I think you did a really good job on changing it, is on the third paragraph, the one that reads, a second motion was introduced. I think we have to be very clear that was a substitute motion.
Yes.
If it were, so instead of saying second motion, say it's a substitute motion, and also in the next one, say it's a substitute motion, because if it's not a substitute motion, we couldn't have done what we did. You can't approve it without working on the first one. You can't have two separate motions. And it would be useful on the discussion of the substitute motion to also record the yes votes, which was everybody else who was there.
Okay.
And the same thing on we went back and brought up the first motion. That's your last change under A. Would you also record the yes votes, please? Not just the no votes, so we know who voted yes. With those changes.
Did you note the spelling mistake in the last?
Yes, there is a spelling mistake in the change. It's ARRA, not AARA, on B, first paragraph. Thank you, Mr. Zimmerman. Anything else? Any other changes? This was a very curious set of actions, so I want to make sure everybody feels comfortable with how it's written up. Mr. Zimmerman.
Maybe approve it.
Okay. It's been moved. Is there a second?
Second.
All in favor? Aye. Aye. Okay. These are approved as modified. Which brings us to our first information item, which is the Metro Matters capital budget. Now, did we change the title on that? Yes, Metro Matters capital budget review. Ms. Kissel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The purpose of this review is actually to provide the committee with a very high-level financial assessment on where Metro is currently on the six-year Metro Matters agreement that we currently have. Given that we actually will be approaching the last year of this agreement next year, the end of fiscal year 2010, the review is primarily to provide a status as well as to give the committee a sense for the size of the capital budget for next year and the size of the impending obligation of projects that will occur in after fiscal year 2010 out to 2011. In this slide here, if we go to this third slide, the development of the Metro Matters Agreement, as you know, was based upon a CIP, which was established back in 2002. Which was the current capital plan from 2004 to 2013. The plan was developed with three goals in mind: to fully fund the IRP as an urgent priority, to fully fund 120 rail car options on the 6,000 series, and to procure 185 additional buses, which would expand the fleet. That was the basis of the CIP. The next slide. Once the board adopted the CIP in 2004, with these goals in mind, this became the basis of the Metro Matters Agreement, which the board adopted in 2004 and was ratified by each of the jurisdictions. Based upon that, Metro set about developing a capital plan and making investments based upon the goals of the CIP, maintaining the aging facilities and the systems into a steady state of good repair, relieving crowding on the rail, accommodating ridership growth that we saw increasing, the eight-car train capability, and to reduce the average age of the bus fleet. At the time, 10 years, reducing that down to an acceptable level and to improve air quality in the region. Next slide. So what I will take you through is each component of the Metro Matters on a very high level, starting with this first chart on the IRP, and then give you a view as to where the financials are currently, and then what the forecasted funding would be for next year. I might add that under Metro Matters Agreement, there are no identifiable specific performance metrics that identifies actually the performance of where we are under the agreement versus how we've performed. But there certainly are strategic performance measures, which I will try to incorporate here and to give you a sense for where we are and how we have progressed on that plan. So if you go to this slide here, the plan under the agreement was to improve service reliability for the infrastructure delay. And the implementation of that investment has occurred over the last 5 years and continues to occur, and service delays have been reduced. The IRP plan also sought to fund the unfunded portion of this investment, which were the pre-Metro Matters projects. And this has been accomplished. In addition to the plan, the 75 buses per year, the original plan was actually to, and it was actually increased to actually 100 buses on a replacement basis. Next slide. So if you look at the financial picture of what I just said, just on the IRP, the Infrastructure Renewal Program, the Metro Matters plan for the IRP was a total of $1.1 billion over the six-year period. The approved budget currently that we have in place for that is $1.4 billion. That $1.4 billion assumes the actuals that we've spent to date, a forecast for where we will be at the end of this year, and then the forecast for the end of next year, which is the last year of the agreement. The ability to spend more on IRP for the steady state of good repair is a direct result of the difference and the deferral that the board had made in prior agreements to defer the expansion plan for buses and actually move towards more of a replacement program for buses. And as a result of that, more investment was able to be provided into the IRP, which is why you see the difference between the $1.1 billion and the $1.4. That decision on the expansion buses was deferred out to 2010. And as a result, Metro Matters 2, or the second agreement, if you will, would hopefully address that expansion, if appropriate. In addition, there was funding savings, if you will, that was a result of the rail system traction power. And as a result, more investment was able to be provided into the steady state of good repair. Most of the projects that you see here that I've listed are very high-level projects that you see. They are not a total comprehensive list because the page would be way too long. But just to give you a sense of some of the projects that were completed and will be completed over the next 15 months that you see here. The next slide. So the plan for the rail car, as you know, was to procure the 126,000 rail car, series rail cars. And as a result of pricing negotiations under that contract, we were able to actually increase the rail car procurement, as you know, to provide an additional 2 rail cars. We also expanded and improved 3 rail yards, Brentwood, Greenbelt, and Shady Grove, and they've been completed. And we've also provided the system capability for the 8-car trains. Next slide. Actually, go back to that slide. I'm sorry. I forgot about the bus. Under the bus program, as I mentioned, the expansion plans were deferred until after FY 2010. And as a result, only 25 buses, actually expansion buses, were procured. And the construction of the bus garage in Northern Virginia West Docks, as you also know, has been completed and is operational as of March 30th of this year. This is, again, just a snapshot of some of the large investments in the projects that we've completed. So in looking at the rail program, the actual versus the forecast, as you can see, we're the plan under Metro Matters was $599 million. We anticipate spending out $570 million. The difference actually is the savings that I indicated earlier, a savings as a result of the power system upgrades. We originally estimated a higher amount on power system upgrades. Actually, that has come in lower. In addition, the last pair of the 6,000 series rail cars was accepted on July 2nd, as you know, 2008. And the Brentwood Rail Yard expansion improvement was completed in June 30th of last year. Greenbelt was completed last year, and the Shady Grove was completed back in 2007. The last of the 66 traction power substations were completed in March of 2009, and these 66 traction substations are located within all of the five rail lines. Next slide. On the bus program, the original plan investment was $172 million in Metro Matters agreement, and the actual forecasted is going to be $70 million, and that's primarily a result of the deferral of the expansion buses out until after FY 2011. Next slide. So this culminates into this one big number slide, which I will take you through. This actually, the first column in this slide, the obligation schedule, is actually the attachment A under the Metro Matters agreement. And what it shows is the investments that were made under that agreement and IRP, or the planned investments that would be made under IRP, the 8-car train, the bus improvement, and also some system expansion and some credit facility fees. The subtotal of all that is $3.1 billion. The plan under Metro Matters assumed a debt funding of $858 million. That $858 million assumes a debt service over an 18-year period. So the agreement itself was a 6-year period. The funding of that agreement actually was out to 18 years, and that's the debt piece. All total, the plan under Metro Matters agreement was $4 billion. The next column, go back to that page, yeah. The next 1, 2, 3 columns that you see, which says expenditure schedule, under Metro Matters agreement, there was obviously a spending plan, which is what we are abiding by. There was some reconfiguration of that spending plan over the last several years under the agreement. As you can see, the original on RRP was, or the reconfigured piece of the $764 million, was dropped down into an item that said pre-Metro Matters expenditures. These pre-Metro Matters expenditures were track improvements, but they were pre-Metro Matters. And as a result, in prior budgets, they decided to break it out to identify it separately versus the new infrastructure renewal program. The other change that you might see is, so as a result, that was the biggest change on the expenditure plan. And as you can see, the current column is where we are now, what we're measuring ourselves against. The bottom line of $2.6 million. Compared to the 3.1. The 3.1 is an obligation plan, which includes the obligation plan. And the 2.6 is really the expenditure or spending plan within the 6-year period. If you go to the next column, which is FY 11 to 24, this $492 million is what I have learned that everyone refers to as the tail, which is actually the amount of expenditures that we will incur after the Metro Matters agreement expires of FY 2010. As you can imagine, a capital plan is a long plan, and those expenditures will be put in place probably 2011 out into 2016. And that's what Metro Matters actually assumed. If you look at the last column, which is the 2005 to 10, which is the actuals and forecast, this just gives us a picture of where we are against that expenditure plan. And as I indicated, I brought you a little bit through the infrastructure renewal plan, the eight-car train, the $70 million to $69 versus the $172 on the bus improvement. And as we page down, the pre-Metro Matters expenditures, we've based upon plan and expenditures, we're pretty much on track to spend out by next year the $2.6 million, or that's what we're planning. The last column that you see on the 2011 is what we call the tail, and we actually plan to bring forward a plan, an obligation plan, if you will, prior to the end of Metro Matters' agreement to the board to look at how actually that plan will be put in place. It will actually tee up the next Metro Matters agreement and a spending plan for that agreement. The 950 that you see there is actually the now estimated long-term debt service that we actually anticipate. We have brought to the board a bond issue, which you have approved, and we will bring to the board, I think, in June, which is when we're ready to issue the bonds. As you can see, there's a bit of a difference between what was planned under the Metro Matters agreement, the $858 million debt service, to where we are currently. I will say two things, that the $950 million was a placeholder when we were looking at that last week. That may come down a bit to more of a $900 million level. It's all predicated on market rates and how we place the bonds. The Metro Matters, and actually I'll take you through the debt strategy chart.
Before you do,
yes?
Can I ask some questions about this one?
Yes, you can.
Okay. If I understand correctly, the 3159 all the way over on the left-hand side, that's the control total of how much we're going to spend on buying things.
That is an obligation total.
It's how much we're going to spend all the way through the end.
But that's correct.
On buying stuff.
That's correct.
Of which 2667 is what we buy through 2010.
That's correct.
Okay. And so if I go to the right-hand side of that, what we originally, towards the right-hand side, what we originally said was we were going to do 2667, that one, right? That 2667 of buying stuff during 2005 to 2010, and another 492 between 2011 and 2024, plus debt service.
That's correct.
And again, we get to the 3159 total. And when you add in the debt service, you have that number down in the corner, the 4017.
That's correct.
Okay. What you're now saying is we're going to spend, this is your last two columns, we're going to spend the 2667 in the period that we said we were, but instead of spending 492 on additional stuff in the out years, we're only going to spend 401. And we're going to take the other $91 million that we could be spending on stuff, buses and rail cars and switches and platforms, and we're instead going to put it into debt service, because debt service has made up that difference between 858 and 950. If I understand correctly, the main thing that drives that is not interest rates, but the fact that we intend to have our debt service run out for a longer period than was originally expected. What that does is it lowers the amount per year, but increases the overall that we spend on interest as opposed to spending on buses and rail cars and platforms. I at least, and I think the state of Maryland, would prefer to have a higher debt service over a longer period of time and move that $91 million back into buying buses and rail cars and fixing platforms and switches. What they're doing is, instead of doing, 18 years?
Yeah.
They're doing a longer period, which means the interest runs for a longer period of time, and all of this is an interest.
Just summed up.
What I'd rather do is have more dollars per year during the years that we do it.
For a shorter period of time,
thereby reducing the interest by $91 million and spending that on other stuff.
Well, and let me actually, can we go to the debt page? Because
sure.
It's the perfect time to talk through that. This is the... let's just flip to the debt page. Right here. Okay. So the 858, which was in the Metro Matters, assumed an 18-year maturity for debt at a 5% rate. It was certainly a plan. And it assumed issuing 611, the top number there, $611 million worth of bonds. What we are currently, and I will say one thing on that 858, I'm not sure how it was developed, because when we do an analysis for debt service or issuing $611 million worth of bonds, the bond debt service payment over 18 years is a lot higher than what was assumed in Metro Matters Agreement. So there's a little bit of an issue that my staff is going back to now to try to understand the underlying assumptions under the Metro Matters Agreement and how the bond schedule or the debt schedule is laid out. That said, and we will follow up with the committee on that, we are only issuing, as we actually asked the board to approve, $550 million worth of bonds. We are only recommending, when we come back to the committee next month, that we actually will only issue $468 million, somewhat less than the 611, and only because I'm only going to recommend issuing bonds based upon what our needs are currently. And we may come back next year if there's an aggressive spending pattern where we can issue more bonds. But that said, we're issuing a less debt. Less debt that we're issuing now of $468 million, we're assuming that that debt is on average has a life maturities of 16 to 17 years. When you issue bonds of this magnitude, some debt has shorter maturities than other debt. We're issuing a 25-year term only because that's what the market appetite is currently now. To issue an 18-year maturity, only an 18-year maturity, somewhat impedes our ability to price it in the market and accept it. So I would ask that we can come back to the board to give you our analysis on what we think is the most prudent way to place bonds of this magnitude into the market, and in terms of a pricing point of view, what is the most prudent. But I would argue that the 25-year term is actually a 25-year debt term, but it has bonds in it that mature at 10 years, at 12 years, at 18 years, and then some at a longer term. So it's a mix of bonds. But in answer to your question, we will look at possibly inputting in a shorter term. It doesn't change the subsidy amount that the jurisdictions have agreed to. So to give you an example, what Virginia and D.C. has agreed to, say it's $100, whether you pay debt service of $50 or you pay debt service of $60, it doesn't matter. Your contribution stays the same. All it does is actually minimize the amount of local match we would have for the federal funds. And what we're trying to do is to minimize the debt dollar amount so that we can actually maximize the local dollar amount we have to use for federal funds to match. So there's a lot of puts and takes to it. And when we come back to the committee to analyze the terms and analyze the impact, we will give you a couple of options that you can agree to.
Thank you, and we appreciate that. That was a very good explanation, very nicely done. And I think what I was trying to say is, now I understand you're going to probably do a several series over several different periods, with the average being about 18 years. What I'm suggesting is that we look very seriously at taking that $91 million that was originally going to go into actual capital projects, and if possible, put those back into actual capital projects, especially since interest rates are relatively low right now, and set up those sequences in such a way that the various series average out at the original number, so we can get back towards more for actual projects. In terms of match of federal funds, we so incredibly overmatch the federal money anyway that I don't see that as a big issue, but were that ever an issue, you can be sure that every single person at this table, I think, without exception, would not let federal dollars go away for lack of local match. Mr. Zimmerman, did you have a comment?
It was just what the bottom line answer to your question was. I guess I'll associate myself with your remarks and comments.
Thank you.
Okay. The next couple of charts actually goes into a whole level of detail on a year by year, which I will not go into at this time, but actually it shows the program budget by year, and then the next page shows the sources of funds, and then we show where we actually have, under the Metro Matters Agreement, the one source of funds that actually did not pan out was the federal discretionary funds that we had assumed at a $260 million, and actually we got a lower amount, as you all know. So we've tried to accommodate for that in a variety of different ways. I will just actually move to the last chart, and happy to answer any questions in terms of next steps. I heard already the next step was we need to look at the analysis on the debt issuance, and we will certainly do that, Mr. Chairman. We will actually look at, in May, we will come back to the board to, this is only a part of the capital program. The other big part of the capital program that Metro has is obviously now what we call the ARRA, or the stimulus project. And we also have a very large reimbursable program, and we'd like to bring both of those to the committee in May. In June, we will actually, as we bring the operating budget to have the board approve, hopefully we have that by June, we will also bring the capital budget for your approval as well. And we will also, when I spoke about the tail or the other obligation piece to, for the end of Metro Matters and the expenditures going beyond, we will actually bring that to the board, this committee as well, so that they can actually look to see the detailed investment that we would like to obligate for beyond FY 2010. I think actually that kickstarts the agreement, the next level of agreement that we would need to do and have among the jurisdictions for what people are saying, calling Metro Matters 2 or the next agreement among the jurisdictions. And I believe this kickstarts that, that project. So, and that's the presentation.
Are there any questions? Mr. Zimmerman.
So on that last part, discussion regarding next funding agreement, you're saying that would begin in June?
I believe that we actually have had some preliminary discussions among a comprehensive group within Metro, including government relations and obviously some of the other jurisdiction staff. And these are preliminary things. What we're looking to do is lessons learned on the Metro Matters agreement we currently have in place and what we'd like to see as a new agreement for the next one. So, yes.
So, yes, we begin that discussion in June?
Yes.
Okay. Any idea when we might conclude such an agreement or what the target would be for?
I don't have a...
We would need such a thing to be done.
The earlier the better, I believe, so that we can actually make assessments and all the jurisdictions can actually put their placeholders in their budget early. I'm very cognizant of that. So my assumption is that we'd like to get something hopefully in place by next fall. Because I think those FY11 budgets actually are, those discussions are happening next fall.
Okay, so that's actually what I was focusing on. Just so everybody heard, Bissell is saying that by next fall we should be figured out what we're doing next on capital. And I think that's really important because what this presentation showed, and I think it's a good review of what we've been doing in this period, we got a lot done. Mm-hmm. However, we don't have anything in place to do anything more, basically. And the way we got to this in the first place, we had started with a 30-year plan, big long-term vision that came out of the completion of the system. We were, building the last of the system, and the question was, okay, where are we going from here? And then we tried to focus that more, in more narrowly to more near-term, and we wound up with a 10-year capital plan, which is referred to here. But the jurisdictions didn't have the funding for it. And because a lot of things collapsed around 2002, just after we adopted a 10-year plan here, and then Virginia voted down a referendum on financing that next month, and other things happened in Maryland, and basically there was no money. So about a year and a half later or so, we had to figure out we were about to lose the options in our rail cars, which is why we moved toward what became Metro Matters. But Metro Matters, a name I never liked, but a program I did, was really a way of getting all the money pulled up as close as you could to put it into getting these, particularly the options on the rail cars, and not losing that, but gambling on the future. And we've pretty much run that string out. So if you look at what we've done, I want to ask a couple of specific questions on that. Precision stopping, and maybe Mr. Francis can answer this, but precision stopping, we're now, it's not really clear, but we're now in a position to implement.
We have gone through the mapping process on where we have to stop and where the trains will stop, and I think now we're going through the software process, and I can have Mr. Kubitschek.
I just want the really short answer. When can I expect to see precision stopping on Metro Rail?
I'm Dave Kubicek, Assistant General Manager of Rail First. Right now, we are testing 8-car trains with this new, the latest software, and we're expecting during the summertime for us to be able to turn the switch to do all 8-car trains stopping in an automatic mode.
Your hope is to do it this summer?
Yes.
You're only hesitation because you're testing now. And
yeah, we're testing.
Assuming it works.
Yeah, well, we've tested on the yellow line and the green line at this stage, and so we're incrementally going throughout the system. And then once we get that information validated, then we'll have to go in and implement this software in 1,000 cars.
Well, hopefully this summer, in any case, that will be a major milestone in one of the achievements of this program. 8-car trains, it says in here that we're now up to 50% capability. Can we actually run 50% 8-car trains, or do we not have enough rail cars to do that?
At this time, we do have enough rail cars to do it. For example, starting Monday, we will be at pretty close to 50% capacity on the green line, and then we are adding rail cars on the red line. We are completing with the substations, completing like the punch list, the items, the final tune-ups and tweaks that we really need to do our calibration before we start adding more equipment. So we're doing it segment by segment. And then the other component is as we start utilizing these rail cars, we're also looking at our scheduling with these merge points, because the red line is pretty straightforward because it's a single standalone line. But whenever you have like the yellow-green where they merge, or the blue-orange, there could be there's a big concern on our part that we put an 8-8-8-8 and all of a sudden we have big problems.
So adequate power.
Yes. And so that's why we're doing it in incremental steps to make sure that we don't create more harm.
Okay, so that's a power issue. Rail car wise, you have enough rail cars to
yes.
do 50% on all the lines?
Yes.
Okay. We had, when we began this, and it was updated over time, we had this chart that was had different colors and kind of what was happening to service over time. And when we started back in 2002 and they first did this, there was all this red, basically, of things slowing down as we had the inadequate capacity. We're basically crowding would get worse and worse. So by buying the additional rail cars, we were pushing the red portion off and the green moving up. Some people here remember the chart. I'm not sure if everyone there does. We don't want to pull it out, because what we need to do is update that. And that's one of the things what I'm interested in, and I'm sure Mr. Couch will remember this. So the question is, we can show now we've moved that out, and so we've got much better capacity now than we otherwise would have had. The question is, going forward now, what do we project? Because right now you have 900 and how many rail cars? 60?
We have 1,040 cars.
Over 1,000, sorry, 1,040. That's total, not in service. It's 900 or something you put in service, right?
Yep.
But you have got everyone we've ever ordered, right?
That is correct.
And right now there are no new ones coming.
That is correct.
We're starting a procurement process.
Yes, the 6K is complete, 2, 3K complete.
And the only thing we've funded so far is the 64 that are coming for the Dulles line, right?
That is correct.
So what we need to start seeing is what happens looking forward if we don't do something to order additional rail cars, because that's part of how people understood what we needed to do 7 years ago. And it really need to be part of this discussion so that everybody can understand what it is we're talking about. It's not all rail cars, but it's one of the things that's easiest to explain and to show people. And then finally, on the bus side, we have a similar thing, and I think we need to make that. When we started this, we had the goal was to enhance bus by 185. I believe it notes in here that at some point we said, well, we got these old buses we need to replace, and we basically just swung the money into there. We kind of gave up on the goal. What did we wind up enhancing the bus fleet by?
I think it was
25. So basically, we have almost the same bus fleet now in magnitude that I think we had 20 years ago.
Well, the average age has gone from 10 to 7.
Yes, that's right. The buses are much better. As one who rides them, I appreciate very much. You can tell the difference. We had 30- and 40-year-old buses when I started on this board, and now we have, now it's the rare time you get one of those rotten old flexibles we still haven't gotten rid of. But basically, the bus fleet is much newer, and that's good. But in magnitude, the size of the fleet we have, while we've enhanced the rail system a lot, we are basically moving our passengers a higher load than we were doing 10 years ago with a bus fleet that is almost the exact same size. And so that's part of what we have to discuss.
And I wasn't here when that decision was made, but I do understand that the deferment to defer the expansion to 2011, part of that discussion was because it increased operating costs, as obvious, and that was the issue. So it's going to impact the operating budget going forward in FY11, depending upon the priority and the investment that we make on the capital side.
As it does to run the additional hundreds of rail cars we have added to the system. We have 600 something, 700 maybe when I got on the board, and now we have over 1,000. And it's a good thing we did that because we're moving a lot more people. I'm just pointing out that, again, rail is always given that kind of priority. The buses in Metro Matters was always an afterthought. It's kind of noted here that we had the 185. That's because Mrs. Mack and a couple of us had one about bus. We put it in there, and we wound up not getting them. We did get an improved bus service and, you know, new facility and all that. That's positive. But basically, we have not invested anything like the amount of into bus the way we have in the rail. Nothing remotely like it. We basically improved an old dying fleet, one that works pretty well, but we still haven't really enhanced the system. Thank you.
Are there other questions or comments? Before we end this particular discussion, let me suggest two things. One is on that very last page on next steps. I hope that in your consideration of the next funding agreement, you'll also look at the null case, by which I don't mean the null case, by which I don't mean no capital program, but no multi-year funding agreement. A multi-year plan that is approved by this board, but not an agreement similar to Metro Matters. We did Metro Matters for some of the reasons that Mr. Zimmerman has talked about. Many of those reasons don't necessarily exist, and there were a number of downsides to having a multi-year program that was locked in place, which this board did not have the ability to modify substantially, only had limited ability to modify. So I hope you will look at that. And also, you say you're going to bring the plan of contracts for 2010. I hope it will be exactly that, a plan, not a request that we approve all of the contracts up front without having any chance to look at them later.
Yes. Okay. It's within the dollar authority that's already established. We're not looking to change that. We wanted to actually give the committee and the board a view of a comprehensive project that was linked to a plan of contracts, similar from what we just did with the stimulus project that was approved. The budget was approved, and the plan of contracts was approved as well.
Well, I think what we want, the line here is we gave the general manager an enormous amount of authority and just essentially said, do whatever contracts you want. I'm not sure that we want to do for an entire year's worth of capital program a do whatever contracts you want approval. So it could be here's the plan and here's some of the contracts maybe, but all of them seems a little much. Now that's something that other people may want to weigh in on. But the wording there was plan, and the plan is fine. Asking for pre-approval now to award when we haven't even seen the contracts might be asking more than at least I would feel comfortable with. If there are no more comments on this item, let's move on to the financials for January and February.
This is an information item, actually, for the month's January financials as well as February. We actually missed January because the committee was busy with other agenda items, so I apologize for that. But just to give you a quick picture of on the bottom line for January, our subsidy, we were favorable to subsidy year to date by $7 million. That's the bottom line for the month of January. Much of the impact of that was due to revenue increases as a result of the inauguration, the revenue on rail was favorable by $7.2 million for the month, which was all due to inauguration, or $6 million of it was due to inauguration. The other million of it, if you will, was due to the decision not to do the fare integration transfer that we would typically do. We take $1 million from rail and put it into bus. We stopped that transfer in January because of the fact that we actually implemented an elimination of paper transfer and the bus transfer. So that said, on the expense side, I will mention that we actually went over on overtime, but primarily due to the inaugural. We had normalized for the inaugural, we would have actually been under overtime for the third month in a row. And those were the puts and takes on January. For February, we've actually had some favorable movement as well. Our year-to-date subsidy currently is favorable by $12.1 million. Yes.
Yeah, I'd like to ask a question. You mentioned the overtime.
Yes.
I thought of the inaugural. And I'm thinking, okay, didn't we request some of that funding reimbursement And what's the status of it?
The status of it, we actually have been having many meetings with FEMA, the organization that would be reimbursing. We are anticipating that the reimbursement, currently the negotiations are that we possibly would be reimbursed a little bit less than $1 million. It's been eroded over time. They're very strict guidelines.
What did we ask for?
We actually asked for I think it was $2.5 million we were looking to. We possibly might be reimbursed by a little less than $1 million. The other cost that we've incurred, actually we're having discussions with the district, because as you know, the district was provided funding in the state of emergency that they declared. And as a result, we would be able to possibly recover some of the other additional monies from the district. And we're having conversations with them currently. Well, that's the status.
Good luck.
Mr. Graham,
I noticed the average weekday bus ridership was down by 4%.
Yes,
in 413,000. The volatility of this is also suggested by February. I don't want to tell your tale too quickly.
No, we can go right to February.
But in February, the bus ridership was
up 10%.
The revenue was up $200,000. But to what do you attribute the fall off in the January bus ridership?
Well, let me answer the question this way. We were scheduled to bring the revenue and ridership projections to this committee meeting to analyze the elimination of bus transfer and all the changes that we had in January. I committed to that. I do not have a sense currently with the January actuals and February actuals as to why my revenue is flat on bus and I have this big increase in ridership. I do have my answer to your question is I cannot explain the ridership increase of 4% for February. Decrease. I cannot explain that ridership decrease in February.
Could it have anything to do with the elimination of the trade and the legal transfer?
The trade in illegal transfer?
Yeah, I mean, we were told, nobody ever knew to what extent this existed, but the transfer of
yes, I do believe that because of elimination of bus transfers, this is impacting this. I can't explain why it is. And what we're doing currently now is assessing the fare integration policy that we've changed, the elimination of bus transfer, and the discounts that we implemented in January to understand
that. How many riders did we have in January on the bus?
Ridership was in January, the ridership on the bus was 413,000.
And how many did we have?
That was average weekday.
Average weekday.
Yeah.
And what was the average weekday for February?
Yes.
Yeah. 437. Average weekday.
Mr. Graham, you've actually hit upon a point, and Ms. Kissel started talking about it a little bit. The disparity in February and what has happened compared to last year is rather shocking. We have a ridership increase on bus of 10% over last year, but revenues from last year have gone down in spite of the fact that there are no more paper transfers. It's almost impossible that happened. So we have talked a little bit, and I think Ms. Kissel started out saying that you don't have an answer yet.
Okay. But she's working on it.
Right. But the point that you've raised,
the point
that you've raised is a very scary one. You look at it and say, this can't happen. You can't have this size of an increase and have revenues go down. Something else is happening.
There's a lot of components that go into it, and I don't want to spend time. I will promise to bring this back, obviously, because we're looking at it. From a lot of different forces in Metro are looking to try to understand this. And I promise that we bring some. So.
There is, however, along the lines of what you've been talking about, Mr. Graham, in the January report, a nice little table that shows, at least initially, and it's subject to all of these other problems, so I don't know how accurate it is, some of the effects of the elimination of the paper transfer. And it's specifically in there. It is not in there in February, I think, because by then staff figured out that they weren't quite sure they knew whether that was or was not the answer. So we do have a serious problem here that needs to be worked on.
Question?
Yes.
Flash passes?
Sorry?
Flash passes?
We have seen an increase in flash passes.
Except to do this number, you would have to have so many that we would have run out of our passes.
So you don't think there's enough there to explain?
People would have noticed that.
Let me just suggest, as they're looking at it, one other place to look at the number, not only on the revenue side, but on the count, passenger count side.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. One possibility is that what's the really big number here, which, you know, just a large magnitude number, is bus passengers. Mm-hmm. And if you did a sensitivity analysis to see how much those other ones, you know, how much this would change with a small change in your estimate on the bus passengers, mm-hmm. that might be interesting. Yeah. Because if, in fact, we just don't have any idea how many people ride our buses.
No, we are looking at that. And actually, because of the increase in Smart Trip on the bus, you know, we're actually able to electronically confirm riders a lot better.
Assuming that the machine works.
Assuming the machine works. I agree. Yes. So there's a lot of we are looking at that.
And you would still have the problem that the old data would still be bad, and there's no idea how bad it is, in what way it's bad, or how you can correct from it.
Yes, your baseline, and I understand that.
One of the issues, Mr. Zimmerman, has always been that the transfers are not accurate. The transfers were not accurately counted, and they were never reconciled between the paper transfers collected and the punches that the operators put into the system, because you could never get the numbers to match.
Yep.
So that you raised an issue as to whether or not even the baseline is correct.
Yeah, I think that, Mr. Chair.
Yes.
I think there's another part there, too. I think do we see a report on the failure of the Smart Trip? That is,
the number of failures?
Yeah, the ability to actually rely upon the Smart Trip.
Yeah, I get reports on the Smart Trip. I see a failure report on it, but it's, yeah, I do. We'll look at that as well, but you're right.
I think the issue you're looking for there, though, mm-hmm. and I think this is an important report, is how often does the Farebox reader fail so that we get no data on Smart Trip usage, as opposed to how often does somebody's Smart Trip fail?
No, it's not.
And then we lose all of that data.
Clarity is the point.
I understand.
When the actual equipment.
Are there any other questions or comments on either? Yes, Mr.
Well,
Zimmerman.
I just want to make sure I understood Ms. Kissel's answer to Cole's question earlier. Inauguration Day, we provided that whole weekend. We provided service at a level we'd never attempted before, and we delivered at considerable expense. Do I understand you to say that the federal government is sticking us for $1.5 million of the cost?
Currently, the discussions that we're having with the federal government, their assumption is that their reimbursement guidelines would only allow us to get reimbursed for less than $1 million currently.
You're estimated that it costs us about $2.5 million, and they don't want to give us $1 million.
Yes.
So the answer is yes. They're looking to stick us for the cost of over $1.5 million in a year. We have a $154 million budget gap we're trying to close. We've had our best day in history that we performed for the federal government for their event, and they're going to stick us for $1.5 million. I just want to make sure I understood that. Thank you.
Mr. Benjamin?
Mr. Dean,
follow up again on that. At what level are these discussions going on? I mean, we need to generate a higher level discussion in Homeland Security, or beyond that, to discuss this further?
Well, it's being worked out at a staff level, but certainly we could raise it to other levels.
Sure. Ms. Hutchins?
You referenced the criteria.
Yes.
And that criteria is?
To some extent, I don't have the details for you, but we can provide it to the committee or all the board members if you like, and I will do that. But primarily, the guideline, one of the biggest guidelines is the revenue that we recovered on that day should offset some of our operating expenses, and that's the basis of some of the criteria. And there's others as well.
Any other comments, questions on the financials? Before we move away from the financials, two things. One, as we're going through all of this, are you doing presentations to the JCC on both operating and capital budgets? Are they involved? Are they?
Presentations with JCC this year primarily focused on service planning, subsidy allocation, those kind of issues.
I think it would be useful for them also to have a chance to review the budget. I don't think we need the formal report that we've had in past years, but it certainly would be useful for them to report, to have a chance to review the budget for 2010 and in the context of 2009. And, you know, that I think is enhanced if we can have at least some form of written budget, which we don't yet have.
Written budget meaning specific tables and schedules?
Yeah, tables and schedules. Doesn't have to be as thick as it has been in years past, but so far this board has not been given a budget. All we have is a bunch of presentations.
Well, and the assumption was that it wasn't closed yet, and that's why we did not produce a book.
But we always produce one that is used by us and more importantly by our staffs to analyze in advance what we, you know, what it looks like when it isn't closed, so we know where the money is going. And for us to carry out our fiduciary responsibility, it would be really helpful for us to have a printed budget, which you did, in fact, promise to us several times.
Well, I did, and I have delayed only because, the goal was to be environmentally correct and to produce a final budget book. Be that as it may, I do understand the issue that you described, and we will try to put together some level of draft schedules that each one of you can have.
Thank you. Moving on to action, there are no other comments. Moving on to action items, the 2010 Metro Access Program Review. Mr. Kent. By the way, this in our package is entirely blue. Does that mean it's different from what we got?
That's correct.
Okay.
Glad you mentioned it because
can you tell us where?
Pardon?
Can you tell us where as you go? Or
yes, I'd be happy to do that.
Thank you.
Good morning. Today's presentation has two objectives. This was originally mostly an information item that was a briefing on economic factors that relate to the paratransit ridership and cost, following up on the presentation on the subject that we gave in December. In preparation for the board's review of the FY10 budget, our general manager directed us to engage in a peer review under the guidance of the American Public Transportation Association to examine policy issues that would have an impact on our demand management and cost elements of the paratransit service, and that review is conducted. While I do not have a formal report from the panel yet, I do have a summary of the findings for you this morning that's part of the presentation. But an additional objective today is also an action item, which is requesting approval of additional contracting authority for the paratransit contract just to extend to the end of this fiscal year, June 30. So with that, I'll begin with a summary again of the financial issues relating to paratransit following up from December. Recapping, the FY2008 operating budget was exceeded by $6.2 million, and as I've mentioned before, that this is a function of higher than expected ridership. The trend continued with the current year budget, where we had originally projected that there was going to be an $8.5 million overrun, but actually the ridership through FY09 to date has been continually increasing from quarter to quarter, and so we've had to revise our forecast. And so at the bottom of the page, you see that now we're saying we see finishing this fiscal year at $77 million, which is a total overrun of $15 million. And I do want to clarify, because Mr. Benjamin raised this point before, that that number is not entirely ridership, that the original FY09 budget did underestimate or actually omitted some fixed costs that should have been in that number. And if that element had been in there, then the delta would have been closer to what we saw last year. But it's even larger because the original budget number omitted avoided some of those fixed costs. And then on top of that, the higher ridership resulted in an even greater variance. And so we felt it was important to inform you, as you're continuing to look at the FY10 budget, that there is an additional risk and that we have updated our forecast based on the information we've gotten for FY09 year to date. But again, I'm outlining that as a risk because, again, you know, the budget has not been finalized, and there's some moving parts there. But we did want to inform you that based on FY09 experience, that's where we see 10 going.
Mr. Kemp, since we just finished the financials, the financials bottom line showed $3 million positive in terms of subsidy savings. We are, in fact, below budget by $3 million on subsidy. All of this has, in fact, been included, right? So yeah. At this point, even though there is an overrun in paratransit, there's enough of an underrun other places to balance that.
Yes, that's correct. We forecasted this.
Mr. Benjamin?
Yes.
So Mr. Albert. You actually asked my question, so I'm glad that this is all budgeted for. But there seems to be a trend here. If you follow, so that we exceeded our budget in 09, in 08, 09, and the expectation is that we will do the same in 2010. Is there a strategy to better align expectations, better align budgets with reality?
What we did, Mr. Albert, is we started with a five-year actuarial study on the ridership that goes from 2008 to 2013, and each year included a range of forecasts, a low and a central and an upper forecast. And what we have seen so far is that in both FY08 and FY09, the actual ridership has exceeded the upper forecast both times. And so I think because of that, one of the things that we're doing is we're going back and updating that actuarial study with more recent information. There were some things that, some additional factors that were not anticipated in the actuarial study, and some of that has to do with shifts in the use of different types of specialized transportation in the region based on changing economic conditions and some programs having to shrink and having issues with their own finances, that more people have been turning to Metro Access for this type of service. And that factor has caused us to have to reevaluate the assumptions that were made when this study was done in 07.
Mr. Graham.
Yeah, I just want to interject that, I mean, clearly we have a success story here, no question about it. But in February, according to the February report, we increased Metro Access ridership increased by 26%. If that continues, you know, because that was much higher than in January, much higher than in prior months, with a 15% above budget, if that continues, then I suspect what you're saying may even be more subject to change if we're seeing increases at this level.
Ms. Hutchins.
I just wanted to go back to Mr. Kent's acknowledgement that while the ridership numbers were important in the shift in the budget, but it was the fixed overrun or cost overruns, what were the specifics about that?
Well, the way that the paratransit service is paid for through the contract has two elements. There's a fixed cost element, and then there's a variable rate that's based on revenue hours provided by the contractor. And what we had done, I'm sure you recall from previous discussions that we modified the paratransit agreement a couple of years ago with some service enhancements that all were represented in the contract as additional fixed costs because they were related to personnel in the call center and things of that nature to improve the way that we were responding to reservation calls and dispatch services and things of that nature. So the oversight was carrying those enhancements forward and making sure that they were included in the subsequent budget year, which, of course, we made sure that we did not repeat that mistake, but it did happen with the 09 number.
So several of you have identified what Maryland sees as a major problem for us, and that really got in the middle of all the other discussions that we've all been having, and that is the increase in subsidy for the state of Maryland for 2010 is about $16 million. $9 million of the $16 is due to paratransit service. And the amount of money we had available to increase our subsidy was about $9 million, a little bit less than $9 million. So essentially, all of our increase went to covering paratransit, which meant that any other increase that was there, we had to do through service reductions. And so that's how we got stuck with some of the very large service reductions, was that our money went to cover paratransit increases. And that's the continuation of this trend is going to cause us to have even bigger issues in years to come as we are unable to cover the inflationary costs of the rest of the system because we're just trying to cover the successes of paratransit. Mr. Kent, is there somebody else who wanted to comment?
Mr. Kent, what region has had the biggest growth in paratransit?
Well, I would echo the sentiments of Mr. Benjamin that it absolutely has been Prince George's County first.
Page 93.
But primarily Maryland.
Seems like we're getting beat up on every week in here. Come on.
There are some reasons for all of these things, and we can go back and look at them. I don't know if this is the proper time for a discussion, but thank you for that explanation.
I don't think it's just Prince
George's. No, it's both counties.
Both counties.
That's why we pay 65% of the subsidy.
I wasn't picking on you, sir. I was actually identifying it's Maryland.
It is.
And
Mr. Zimmerman also had a comment.
Just jumped on one of the things that's easy to forget about for this is that we're looking at the data not for paratransit in the Washington area, but for metro access. The biggest paratransit service, the one that's basically under the obligation, but in fact, total paratransit service, some of that and all other services provided, such as, what's it called, the Fairfax?
Fast Trans.
Star and Arlington and so on and so forth. Is there any place where the data is gathered that watches this, you know, on a regional basis?
I don't have anything recent, but I can tell you that when I looked at this a couple of years ago when we were putting the study together, that Metro was handling about 30% of the market share for the region. So there are many other services and other providers, but each of them, you know, they're smaller in size than Metro Access is. But Metro's share of the market, I'm sure, is significantly larger than it was 2 years ago based on the numbers we're seeing.
The reason I'm asking is that if you're looking at what's happening in trends, and especially if you're interested, for instance, is something different happening in Maryland than somewhere else, it's hard to tell when, you know, it's administered differently in the jurisdiction. So, you know, at the very least, you want to look at, I mean, if I were in Maryland, I'd be wanting to say, what's going on in Virginia? But I wouldn't know from looking at the Metro Access data. I'd need to know these other things, too. And so somebody somewhere in the region needs to be, you know, gathering this in a way that you can even analyze what's going on.
Well, and as Mr. Kent just noted, what's happening is many other providers of service for this group of persons with disabilities are shedding their service. And a lot of our growth is not just new people showing up because they're new to the region or they just became disabled, but that other people are not providing the service.
And it's hard to distinguish those things
right
with the limits of the data. The other thing that I would request, it would be nice if we could have a table, like one page maybe, or at most two, that just showed the growth in this service. And again, it gets into the same complication. I mean, we'd like to see it from Metro Access, but we'd really like to be able to map paratransit since the beginning, since this mandate began. In, you know, how many just riders as well as costs, and you know, like an annual basis to get a sense of how this is growing in importance as a component of the transportation system.
Can I add to this? We also have service providers, because I think over that same time period, there may have been the elimination of service providers in certain areas as well. So that has that created more of a delta for metro services when there is a subsidized
metro's picked it up.
Yeah, so that needs to be shown as well.
Or maybe if we could start with just one that's Metro Access, which few should have ready to hand. The other stuff, I realize, may be more challenging to pull together.
We'd be happy to bring back the historical perspective on ridership and cost to the Customer Service Committee if you'd like to review that in 2 weeks.
Go ahead.
So this kind of provides a backdrop for why the general manager wanted to begin looking at policy issues. So, of course, the impact of all the financial numbers that we mentioned on the contract is detailed on this page, showing that the original contract that was approved by the board in 2005 is a four-year contract with two-year renewable options, total value of $540 million, with the base period ending this coming January 14th. And as of the end of January of this year, we have already expended $185 million on the contract, and that given the current consumption rate, we're seeing that we will exhaust that contracting authority by the end of May. So obviously we wanted to come forward, make you aware of that, and request approval at least to the end of the fiscal year, while you're still reviewing the FY10 budget information.
So you're asking for 1 month for it?
Yes, sir.
$6.5 million to cover 1 month. And why are you not just asking for authority through January of 2010?
Contract authority for 2010 will come with approval of the budget.
So you're going to ask for contract authority for this?
Yes.
Or for lots of things?
For the whole 2010 budget when the budget is up for approval.
Go ahead.
The first policy issue that we took a look at, and also with the assistance of the APTA peer panel, was the notion of the Metro Access service area and the service hours as compared to the baseline requirement in the ADA. And we had been asked for an estimate previously of what the potential savings would be if we were to roll back the service area and the hours to that baseline. And I just wanted to point out, I had been told that the $750,000 annual figure that had been mentioned some time ago was actually a very crude estimate based more on how many customers were paying the supplemental fare. We have since that time had the ability to update our digital mapping system and very precisely identify all of the outside of corridor trips, both those that are being taken outside of the hours of service that would normally correspond with bus and rail, as well as the geographic location. So a more solid number is the $2.8 million that we mentioned recently. But we also added for your consideration the month of January, a detail of all of those trips that we found to be outside of the ADA corridor and what the percent total is of all of the trips that were provided in each respective jurisdiction. And that's one of the reasons why the blue page was necessary. There was a calculation error on one of them, so that the District of Columbia specifically is only 0.75 of 1%. There are 394 unique customers that would be affected by this. And of course, I discussed this with some of your staff, that there is a difference between out-of-corridor trips that are a result of the service hours versus the area, because the way that it would work if we were operating directly in conjunction with bus and rail is that if a particular bus route has unique hours, then the paratransit service within three-quarter of a mile of that route would also only be offered during those same hours. So it would be very important for our paratransit reservation system to have a data layer in its mapping system that shows the location of all the routes as well as the hours that they run individually, which is capability that we have. So that's why we were able to provide more precise data. But this is something that we have been doing from the beginning of the service. We operate paratransit service to the county line of all member jurisdictions, regardless of the proximity to the ADA corridor.
So just to recap that, so we can think in terms of a $2.8 million annual saving if we maintained, if we just met the ADA minimum.
That's correct.
In terms of the
And it has the potential to increase, obviously, with the overall ridership increase that we see each year. But the other important point is that if the out-of-corridor issue were only service hours, some customers could choose to ride at a different time and would still be using the service. But what we found is that more often than not, that the hours and the geography have a relationship with each other. So in most cases, it is going to cause the customer to not be able to access the service unless they were to come into the ADA service area and change the time of travel. So that's, at the moment, this again is just offered for your consideration. But I think what it highlights is that, again, as you were mentioning earlier, the share of specialized transportation services that Metro provides, in contrast to what other services are available in the region, there's a need to look at how those resources are being shared.
Mr. Lyon.
Does the FTA, are they still funding the New Freedom Program?
Yes, sir.
Which is, in fact, the money for basically similar access programs in areas that are not served, but they are not applying that to existing service that is underfunded.
That's right, and in fact we're pursuing some of those funds and also the job access reverse commute funds to leverage travel training, because that gives our paratransit customers other choices.
Is there any way that any of the service that we're providing that's can be targeted towards New Freedom money?
The fund for the region is a little over $1 million, and we are participating in the selection process at the end of this month to access that money specifically for the purpose of leveraging regional travel training. That's another reason why we're also looking at the job access reverse commute money, because that's a larger fund. And the fact is that people with disabilities also very often are low income and have difficulty accessing employment. And Metro Access fulfills that transportation need, so we felt that that was a legitimate place to seek alternative funding.
Yeah, I mean, that's one possibility, is try to look for whether we qualify in some of these other federal funds that will probably meet some of the same clientele.
Yes, sir.
A question.
Ms. Hutchins.
When we're looking at options to look at strategies to approach, do we have data on what the ridership demand is for, that is job, travel, or other type of travel, so that we can?
Not among the Metro Access trip data, because ADA paratransit cannot distinguish trip purpose. It needs to be made available for any travel need. So our data doesn't capture that. That doesn't mean necessarily that we wouldn't be able to pull it from other sources, maybe surveys or things like that.
Yeah.
But it's not in the data we typically collect.
Okay.
If you'd like me to
research
that. I think
that's important information, and it helps us look more broadly around the larger service that we provide. That is, what's different in our regions that we're doing versus what you're doing for Metro Access. And I think the survey is probably the critical one to do it.
Good. Okay. The second policy issue had to do with the fare structure. And at present, and this has been the case for a number of years, we charge a flat rate of $2.50 for each one-way trip on Metro Access. We do have, add a footnote to that, there is a $1 supplemental fare that we charge for every 3 miles beyond the corridor until you get to 12 or above, and then the maximum fare would be $6.50. And that's our current fare structure. And just to highlight, there's no value pricing here. It's not indexed or related to any other factor. It's simply it's really an evolution of a decision that was made some time ago to make the paratransit fare twice the base bus fare. So in subsequent fare increases, it's been adjusted proportionally. But the point here to look at is that the ADA does permit us to set the paratransit fare at twice whatever the comparable fixed route fare would be, so that might also include the rail fare structure. So that's just a point for consideration.
Mr. Kent, you're not really talking about how an increase in the fare to, say, the equivalent bus plus rail fare times two would be would generate much revenue.
No.
We're only getting 5% cost recovery anyway.
No.
But it might cause people to take alternative transit service as opposed to paratransit service if that were the case.
You know, I think that's why we were expressing it as no value pricing, because it's not market. It's, you know, we're not, it doesn't take into consideration elasticity, as you're saying, or other, you know, other elements of demand management. So that's why it's worth looking at.
And we don't charge a premium for off-hour service.
We do not.
Mr. Lynn.
Yeah, I was going to say that in conjunction with your travel training, it's good to see what those numbers are, because it could incentivize some who have the ability to be able to use the existing system, coupled with the travel training that will assist them in their ability to take advantage of it. They could act in reducing some of our demand for our parents that they act in concert.
Well, we are fortunate that our fixed route system is one of the most accessible in the world. And I think that, you know, there's always a benefit in selling that and promoting that more, because when the customer chooses fixed route over paratransit, they have more independence of travel. There's no reservation required and things of that nature. So that's something we're going to look at. The APTA peer review was conducted the first week of March. And the participating sister transit agencies were New York City, Philadelphia, and Chicago. And unfortunately, the Los Angeles folks were stopped by snow in the D.C. area, so they could not join us, but they are providing some additional data. And again, you can see the same major policy issues were being reviewed, and in addition, also the eligibility certification process and other customer amenities that we currently offer. The findings from the panel are summarized here, and basically it's just an affirmation that we do exceed the ADA baseline requirements in paratransit service, and I'd say parenthetically that they agree that it was a success story. So they said, looking at the ADA baselines, that in each case there is a legitimate option for the board to consider about limiting the service to the ADA three-quarter mile corridor and service hours on bus and rail, because we do have the mapping ability to define that. The second, with the fare structure, we would have to make some programming changes to make it possible for a paratransit customer to know exactly what their comparable fixed route fare would be. But with that capability, that would be a legitimate policy consideration.
With that in mind, Where do we rank in terms of those other cities in terms of providing service beyond ADA limits?
Well, it was an interesting range of feedback, because they all commended us for going above and beyond, and all felt that we were providing much more than they were. They also
everybody enjoys our success. I understand.
Yes. Yes.
That's not answering my question.
Well, you say, where did we rank?
Where do we rank compared to Philadelphia, Chicago, and others in terms of how closer are they to providing service that meets ADA minimum requirements, and where do we rank in comparison?
Well, they are.
Review study. How do we rank?
They are unable to do either of the first two items because they don't have the technology that we do in our system. So their service definition also is not a precise match to the ADA service area either. But, you know, at least they did not have the ability to distinguish between an in-corridor and out-of-corridor trip the way that we do. So they are, in some cases, providing additional service, like Philadelphia, for example, provides service throughout the city. The city limits, no matter what, without looking at the routes. And then they have some different kinds of definitions for the suburban counties that surround. The characteristic of New York City is different. So, I mean, I guess
there's no apple to apple comparison.
Not really. Right. The one strong recommendation that they did make, though, is they do think we should implement conditional eligibility. And what that we are, that's in our business plan, and we are moving forward to do that. But we will do that with full vetting with the community, because, you know, when we do make process changes like that, want to be specific, we're not talking about changing the criteria. What we're simply doing is saying that after we determine a customer's ability to use the bus or rail system, we're going to, you know, when we record our finding, we're going to be specific to say that if there are times that they can use bus and rail, even if it's not 100%, we're going to say that, and we're going to encourage the customer to do that, because even if they get Metro Access certification, every time that they choose bus or rail, that produces a savings, and it gives them the opportunity to take advantage of the free ride program.
So by conditional eligibility, you mean one time I may be eligible, another time I'm not, and it depends upon some external factor like the trip I'm taking or the time of day.
Like time of day, if they're low vision and nighttime is a challenge, that would be an example. If they're susceptible to weather conditions, that would be another, you know, heat or cold, that sort of thing. So what we would do is we would grant eligibility, but with those stipulations.
Mr. Selman.
Yeah, how often do you look at this eligibility requirement? Is it a one-year cycle to review, or how often do
three
you
year. It's a three-year cycle.
And what kind of data do you capture in the eligibility review? Age, income, major disability?
Again, because of the trip purpose issue of not inquiring beyond what's necessary to make the ADA determination, what we generally have is whether or not the customer travels with an assistant and what kind of mobility device that they use, if they're a wheelchair customer or if they're an ambulatory customer, but it's not really drilled down much further than that.
Mr. Graham?
You assembled a peer review, right? And you didn't have people from LA, but you had them from New York, Philadelphia, Chicago. What are those cities' policies regarding and the conditional eligibility?
Well, some of them are using conditional eligibility, so that's
only
why.
Only three.
Right. Well, I'm sorry. Chicago and New York are using conditional eligibility, and Philadelphia is working on putting it together. But none of them had the technical ability to limit to the ADA corridor, so they're kind of they just sort of have blanket policies about covering their service area.
And what about free trip? About
the free ride program? Some of them have that. Again, I don't have that right in front of me, but I would say that some of them are doing it. Some of them also include seniors. But I can bring that back if you.
And what are they experiencing in terms of explosion?
It's pretty uniform. In fact, New York and Metro are fairly lockstep with the increases.
So they're having the same experience.
They are.
Just thinking about this peer review and the findings that you see here, one of the things that we get, although we provide, I think, really, really good service, is lots of complaints about the service.
Less than it used to be.
That's than it used to be, but there's still complaints. I don't see anything here about any suggestions for actual improvements in the service or concerns about what we're doing. Were some things like that also brought out?
Well, we were asked to stick mostly with the economic issues, but I will say, though, that we did discuss this when they toured our facilities. We did talk about customer service, and the one suggestion that they did have is that they felt that if we had the ability to handle more of the investigative process in-house, that they thought that's something that they were all doing, that we were not doing as much of. So we handle intake internally, but then we asked the contractor to do the research and the response, and one of their suggestions was that if that could be a single process, that might be more efficient.
They all have the same kind of problem with lots of people complaining. Was the sense that they have that our service is substantially better than theirs, the same as theirs, worse than theirs?
I would say they thought that we were doing a better job. They were impressed with our statistics, particularly our on-time performance. That was, you know, and of course in Philadelphia's case, I mean, there was a major comparison because they had a very lengthy lawsuit over the quality of their service that went on for almost 14 years, a special master was assigned to the service, and it took them a very long time to right their ship. And even when they were finished, their statistics are still not as strong as Metro's.
So can we conclude that their, maybe this is an official finding or not, that their observation is that despite the fact that they and we get lots of complaints about the quality of the service, we in fact probably provide a higher quality of service than those other major cities?
Absolutely.
That's an important observation. Mr. Zimmerman.
First, are we going to actually see the peer review?
Yes. They needed a little more time to put out a formal report, but given the timing of the committee meeting, we wanted to give you the salient
the
policy
yes,
issues.
We're going to be seeing it.
Yes, sir.
Okay. Well, then in that time, maybe we'll be able to understand some of these things better. Let me ask specifically. I'm told that in these areas, the New York, Chicago, Philadelphia, and Los Angeles, that each of them has somehow divided the service into sectors, and that they feel that improves service quality and reduces costs.
Well, I'm not saying they administer it by region. I'm just saying that we were speaking of it in terms of where they how they define their overall service area. That they do in their central core, like in their central business district, they have some policies where they say that they won't, you know, that they'll serve any location within that region. But in terms of how they administer the service, it's not necessarily divided up into separated regions.
Well,
especially in New York, because the service area is fairly compact.
I guess, again, maybe it'll be clearer when we're presented with the actual report, but I am told that, in fact, in each of those cities, they divide the service regionally that way, and that they assert that the quality is improved and the cost is reduced. If that is so, then the question is, why would this region be different, and is there a way we could administer it that would be lower in cost and perhaps higher in quality? And were they asked that question, and does that, you know, is that then addressed?
I think it was generally acknowledged that each system has unique operating characteristics, and that Washington in particular has some very unique characteristics, that travel patterns and where people want to go really matters, and that if they want to travel across the region, you know, like in New Jersey, which was not part of this review, they actually require the customer to transfer if the trip is of a particular length. We don't have that requirement here. So those are the types of things.
The differences in the way we choose to do things. If everything's unique, then there's no point in having a peer review in the other system. But, you know, I guess ultimately I'm interested in seeing whether a review from people in other regions actually produced some suggestions about how we might do something better by doing it the way they do it, or if the conclusion is, no, you guys actually do a better job than anybody else, as Mr. Benjamin was trying to get at, in which case we should hear them say that.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, okay. I think the final report is going to make that quite clear.
Yeah, it would be helpful if you might transmit to the people who are writing the final report that we'd be particularly interested in their observations on those issues.
And whether it's just about fair policy and service boundaries, or if they actually were looking at the administration of the service itself.
Mr. Linton?
No.
Okay. Let me ask one other question. When you get all of this report in, can you also share it with the JCC? And
I'll be glad
about
to.
It? Thank you so much.
The next steps, again, given the strong recommendation for conditional eligibility, just wanted to update the board that we are centralizing the eligibility function here at the building, that center is going to be opening soon, which is going to allow Metro to have much more direct scrutiny over that process. And the nice byproduct for the customer is that the determinations can be handled more expeditiously. And, of course, all of the planned changes to eligibility will be fully vetted with our advisory committee and the community as a whole. And I mentioned the grant activity that we're pursuing for travel training. And finally, the action item today was to request the $6.5 million in additional contracting authority for the paratransit contract to take us to the end of this fiscal year. That concludes
motion,
my presentation.
A motion on
approval.
Is there a second?
Second.
Mr. Solomon, and the second was Mr. Linton. He beat you by a second there. All in favor? Say aye.
Aye.
Anybody opposed?
What is the next step regarding the condition eligibility, and
My understanding was that if we were to entertain any of those suggestions, that would require a public hearing.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I think it would be good also to hear the full review and see if there's anything else we need to understand from that before we make an action. That would be more helpful.
The next step would be to hear the full review.
We'll transmit that report as soon as we receive it.
Thank you.
One more, Mr. Walton.
Who's our AFSCME representative? I think it may help if we raise the paratransit cost issue nationally and see if we can look at something for the authorization as an industry to look at this.
Authorization. Well, I think there are two parts to that, one of which reviewing what's happening throughout the country and seeing if there's a similarity of experience would be very, very good. And I'm not quite sure where you insert that at APTA. The latter I'd be more than happy to bring up as part of the authorization process, which is on hold at the present moment. Does anybody know any good place to insert this in APTA? Would any staff person know?
I can explore.
Okay. Mr. Zimmerman, we'll look into that aspect, and I'll look into the authorization aspect. Does that conclude this item? If so, we have an item on the Anacostia Light Rail Reimbursable Project. Mr. Graham.
In the interest of time, may I move this item? There's no impact on
second.
It's been moved and seconded. The only question I have is this money actually in-house?
Yes, it is.
So we're not waiting for authorization for the money to show up?
No, this is interest earned on the funds that came over from the district. So.
Okay. All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? That concludes this meeting. Without objection, the meeting is adjourned.